This is 5 of 7, Part A of a child guidance series given by Frank Phillips. Feel free to copy and share with others.
Correct.
It's got to be important. But why are habits important? We're just reviewing just a little bit now to try and pick up what, I mean, if we just go through this and we don't get the main points, we're sort of wasting our time in some respects. And I don't, we don't want to do that. Yes. Well, this is very true, very true.
You know what you're waiting for? It's that quote about the habitual life and not just the
Go ahead and say it.
Well, this is, that's from Steps to Christ, but that's not what I'm really waiting for, but it does reveal, it is a part of that which actually, to me, is the key. And I may look at this entirely different than you do, but I like to think that at least there is something that is more fundamental about this than what we have touched on yet. Habits really reveal character. And the character, we're told, is formed in the first 3 years of a child's life. What they are in their habitual life then, they will be throughout their whole lifetime, unless a miracle of God comes in and actually changes them through complete and total conversion and surrender. This is why it is so very, very important that a child learn correct habit patterns. Now, with this in mind, tell me, now, when we just touched on some of this rather haphazardly last week, but tell me, what do you do to begin a training process of correct habits in a child? How do you do this? How do you go about developing correct habits?
Being consistent.
Consistency, this is true. This is certainly very, very true. In the very first place, the thing that Don hits on here, though he didn't hit the nail just exactly on the head on it, but it's almost, our own habit patterns, you say. Our own habit patterns. If I am actually inclined and give in to flying off the handle easily, Junior, at 2 years of age, his little mind is functioning, and he says, that's the way to do it. That's the way to get the job done. No matter what it is, you see, if I am actually inclined to be a nagger, there's none here, I'm sure. But if I'm inclined to be a nagger, little Susie says, my, when I, you know, want something, the way to do it is to nag mother. And the way to develop then good habits in the child is to actually what? Reveal the kind of thing that you want to see in the child yourself. That places a tremendous responsibility on us, doesn't it?
I think last week some people went home from here
discouraged,
disheartened. They felt like life is pretty tedious. I can't see all these wonderful things. And so we want to bring off the hope.
All right. Now, suppose that I have some bad habits. I don't want them to see in my child. Now what do I do?
That miracle you were talking about has to happen.
All right. But suppose that miracle hasn't happened yet.
You have to surrender to God.
All right. All right, but this is very true. But even though I surrender these to the Lord, and I'm sincere and honest about this, and I ask God to take them away, these habit patterns in my life are not actually erased in a moment of time, are they? No, they're not. Because the habit patterns are there in the flesh. In the flesh life, they are there. As far as God is concerned, the power is broken as far as the habit patterns are concerned, but they're still there in the flesh life. Satan no longer is going to be served willingly in my life, but those habit patterns can be stimulated by Satan, and so they're there. Now, I'm in this kind of a mess, and I recognize that I've got some habit patterns that I don't want Susie. I've got a habit pattern that I don't want my little daughter Susie to develop. I have surrendered this to Christ myself, and I don't want it to be repeated now. Yet it reveals itself in me. Now what do I do, Susie?
When you see it in your child, because you're aware of it yourself, you'll be aware of it developing in your child, and when you see it, you take steps to stop it. Well, yeah. A little before it gets to be a habit.
Correct. This is true, but what do I do when I see it myself?
Well, they have to see you sorry when you get the coming out. You know it's bad.
Correct. You see? One of the main problems that we face in a situation, in all of these situations, is the fact of being totally honest with our children. If I goof, I goof. And I ought to be perfectly frank and honest and say, Susie, Daddy goofed. He certainly made a mistake. I did this thing. I don't want to do it. I've asked Jesus to take this out of my life. I know that I just made a mistake, and I want you to know that I know this, and I'm sorry for it. And you simply confess this to, and ask a little child to forgive you. Now,
At what age? Now we're talking about children from birth to three. At what age do we make these confessions to children?
As soon as the child is capable of actually understanding. And how old would that be? To some children, it might be 2 years of age. To others, it might be four. But nevertheless, as soon as that little child begins to comprehend what this is all about, I think that we must recognize that if I expect my child to be willing to admit mistakes, then I certainly can't be protecting my own. I've got to be perfectly frank and admit these mistakes, and if I do, then I can expect in return the child to also be willing to confess to the Lord and to surrender to the Lord. This is the prime goal that we have, and this is the only way it's going to be accomplished. Well, we could spend another evening on habits here, but we're not going to do that. I asked my wife to write on the board here this matter of training the will. We have touched on this a couple of times, but there's a whole section, and I hope you read it, in Child Guidance. On page 209, there's a section in here on the will, a factor in success. And there are a number of statements here that are so important. This is a short chapter, but there are so many statements here that are so vitally important that I feel like I should read them. There is a statement here from Volume 1, page 390. The mother's work commences with the infant. She should subdue the will and temper of her child and bring it into subjection. Teach it to obey. As the child grows older, relax not the hand. Very, very clear, concise. One taken from Counsels to Parents and Teachers, or on page 112, the child who is spoiled has a heavy burden to carry throughout life. Trial in disappointment, in temptation, in trial, in disappointment, in temptation, he will follow his undisciplined, misdirected will. Children who have never learned to obey will have weak, impulsive characters. Children who have never learned to obey will have weak, impulsive characters. Another thought, Counsels to Teachers, page 112 also. Never should they, that is children, be allowed to show their parents disrespect. Self-will should never be permitted to go unrebuked. The future well-being of the child requires kindly, loving, but firm discipline. Now, there are some statements here that are so comprehensive, but I'm going to try and touch on them just as lightly as we can, and at the same time bring the main points of this particular chapter that for us to discuss. Now, we are told here that the will is the governing power in the nature of man, bringing all other faculties under its sway. The will is not the taste or inclination, but it is the deciding power. Now, we haven't touched on this particular phase of this, but I think that we might just as well make a statement here on this. The will of man is that center which is the deciding power in man, which operates in the highest area or section of the human brain. It is that section of the human brain where actually value decisions are made. This is why you say a very healthful, simple diet should always be the fare of both parents and children, but especially children. For the simple reason that all of harmful foods of any kind have a direct effect upon the higher centers of the brain. This has been experimentally proven time and time and time again in research projects. Condiments, spices of any kind, sugar, an imbalanced diet, many, many, many different factors affect the higher senses of the brain, the higher faculties of the brain. I don't know whether you have ever noticed this. I'm sure that you probably have. But when you feel ill, you just don't like to make decisions, do you? Don't go away. You know, I don't feel like making a decision. The reason you don't feel like making a decision is because you really can't. You can't make a real intelligent decision. And sickness, and when a person doesn't feel, and it's amazing that, you know, children as well as adults, very, very few of them really live in the prime. And the reason is because actually the diet, exercise, the health program that God gave is not followed. It was for this reason, you say, that God gave to the people of Israel as they came out of Egypt a health program first, because they were to make value decisions all the way through. And they could not make value decisions because of the poor habit patterns that they had formed, and the habit patterns were those primarily connected with the appetite. And the appetite was so poorly governed and trained that actually they could not resist, you see, the inclination to follow the habit patterns. And just as soon as God gave them angels' food, they said, "We don't want it. We want Egyptians' food." Why? Because the habit patterns have been trained this way. Their taste buds have been titillated this way. And they said, "That's what we've got to have." And they got it. They never were able to make value decisions. And a whole generation of them died in the wilderness as a direct result. Now, this is only one facet of this, but it's nevertheless a very, very important. The power, yes?
How long did it take them for them from the time they left Egypt to lay their appetite was habits and appetite was such that they could? I mean, it affected them, right?
They never did.
I mean, how long should it take?
Well, you see, the brain, the body has a tremendously recuperative capacity. If we do one thing, if we break with evil habits, bad habits, and correct them with good habits, and particularly in the matter of healthful living, because it's just amazing what really does take place. Somebody said today when we were in eating lunch in here, potluck, that I've forgotten who it was anyway, but somebody said in there, "Well, I sure learned something this past week anyway." I said, "What'd you learn?" And she said, I learned not to give in to my feelings and, not to just indulge. And then she went on to amplify this thing. She'd been somewhere and she indulged in foods that she hadn't eaten for, several weeks. And she said they just completely turned her inside out, And she'd eaten them before just, regularly, and it didn't disturb her at all. The system accommodates itself to proper healthful living very, very rapidly if one will actually follow that course. But this isn't a health lecture tonight. But it does affect the will, and that's why we're talking about this. A child or an adult who actually is not in good health, it's a very difficult thing for their will, which is the power of decision. It's that area of the brain that makes value decisions. And it's very difficult for that to operate except a person is in good health. And so this is a very very important part.
I think there's another facet of this too, not only the good health, but the very habits of indulgence. If we indulge ourselves from childhood up, if we let them eat every time they're hungry, let them eat what is not good for them and refuse what is good for them, and it's a habit. We get these terrible habits that make it so very difficult. Not so much health-wise, though it does affect their health, but it's something about the mind. It's just, and Mrs. White has so much to say about what appetite and the control, the parents to control these children's appetites, what a tremendous difference it makes in being able to control the children.
Correct. The controlling of the appetite not alone is physiological, but it is also a mental discipline. Very, very wonderful mental discipline. I'm going to read you something here. Right, I'll get to you in just a moment, Ellen. Notice what this, here in Adventist Home. She says this on two different places, on page 252 and 259. She says, "The mind and nerves gain tone and strength by the exercise of the will." Isn't that interesting? The mind and nerves. Anyone here have nerve problems? The mind and nerves gain tone and strength by the exercise of the will. The power of the will, in many cases, will prove a potent soother of the nerves. The power of the will. Just put that in your, you know,
bonnet
and buzz it around a little while. Because really, it's this is, you know, when you work around hospitals a long while and you realize that the neurosurgical ward of every hospital in the nation is the busiest ward, and you ask Don about that. This is the place where every hospital could use two or three times as many beds as they have in that particular area, because most people have their sickness in their minds and in their nerves.
Psychosomatic.
Okay.
Alan has his hand up.
Alan, yes.
Yeah, I wanted if you could discuss the attitude on this too. I find, you know, when I'm in my sickness, you know, I get cold or something, you know, I don't know when I see a lot of cold. But it seems to me to be pretty much related to my attitude. You know?
Correct. This has a lot. The mind has. Well, best thing I could refer you to there is if you read Ministry of Healing, in the section Mind Cure, there's a whole chapter in there on this. The mind has a tremendous influence on the physical body. And if you read that section, it'll answer all. I don't think you can ask. I don't think you can even entertain a question that isn't answered in that chapter. The control that the mind really has. The mind is the central control system of the entire body. Physiologically, it is. Mentally, it is. Neurologically, it is. It is absolutely the control center, and we have to face this. And this is the. Let me read to you. I didn't finish reading here. The mother needs to the most perfect self-control. I shouldn't have read that. And in order to secure this, she should take all precautions against any physical or mental disorder. Her life should be ordered according to the laws of God and of health. As the diet materially affects the mind, now here we have it, and disposition, it's getting deeper, she should be very careful in that particular, eating that which is nourishing but not stimulating, that her nerves may be calm and her temper equable. She will then find it easier to exercise patience. These are really tough statements, aren't they? But these are answers, this isn't just bringing the problem, these are the answers. Patience in dealing with the varying tendencies of her children and to hold the reins of government firmly yet affectionately. Now, what is the center of this?
Justice and mercy.
Take care of yourself.
Take care of yourself, you say. Take care of yourself. Make sure you, and don't underestimate the value of understanding what the health message that God has given is. And it's not just granola. That's, you know, we need to be very careful that we don't go and become health faddists and you're just sick a different way, that's all. That's a very, very wrong direction to move. We need to know what the health program actually is and follow it. All right. Now, my. Don't push me now.
Well,
I know. When she begins to cough, though, I know something's wrong.
Oh, no. I'll poke you when it's time.
Okay. All right. Every human being possessed of reason has power to choose the right. Now, that includes everyone here. Everyone may place his will on the side of the will of God. Then this tremendous statement follows. May choose to obey him, and by thus linking himself with divine agencies, he may stand where nothing can force him to do evil. This is page 209, Child Guidance. In every youth, every child, lies the power, by the help of God, to form a character of integrity and to live a life of usefulness. That is inherent in the child. Now, what is our responsibility then? To train, you see, the will. This is there. We can direct it, or we can let the child develop as he will, and his will actually be a destroying power rather than a benefit to him. Now, she says that the child must have the will trained, but she says, to the superficial observer, his work may not appear to the best advantage. In other words, the work of training the will, the effort that goes into this may not appear as to its best advantage, but she goes on and say it may not be valued so highly as that of the one who holds the mind and the will of the child under absolute authority. Have you ever seen that done? Somebody who just really controls the will under the absolute authority of a parent? Oh, yes. But she says that is in reality not the thing that pays off in the end. She says, but after years will show the results of the better method of training the will. Training the will. And it's for the child's after years that we're after. Save all the strength of the will. Page 210. For the human being needs it all, but give it proper direction. Now save it, but train it. Give it proper direction. Do not hammer it in pieces, but by precept and true example, wisely fashion and mold it until the child comes, and notice this now, until the child comes to years of responsibility. This is actually a work that can only be done during that short period of time. Now, does this remind you of a mother in the Bible? Samuel? Yes? Moses' mother. Jochebed. Jochebed had Moses for 12 years. She knew that she was going to have him. And this is, maybe give or take, one way or the other, a little bit, but this is generally what we think is a years of accountability. She knew that she would have him, and that child's will had to be completely trained at that time. It was gone. Now, the real interesting part is you don't have any longer either. You may have the child around, but you don't have any longer to do the job. You don't have one bit longer. None of us do. When the child reaches the years of accountability, that child's will is out of your hands.
Yes. You're not saying if you haven't done anything, the child will, by the time it's 12 years old, you haven't got a chance.
No.
No, this isn't the point. But then you have to work on a different basis that the child himself, you say, recognizes. And we're told here that we should train, every child should understand the true force of the will. You have to start back, you say, and actually then bring the child to do this surrendering himself, you say, if you miss the thing. But actually what we're doing as dealing with a child is getting him his habit patterns formed so that it's the natural thing for him to surrender to the Lord, because he has surrendered his will willingly to mother and dad. You see, this is the
something you said before is about it not being a parent for many years, which is the better way to have absolute authority. And that reminded me of a quote Sam Levinson used in his book about his father. His father would say, "I don't care what you think of me now, it's what you think of me 20 years from now."
Correct, correct.
Very good.
And this,
Sam. I was thinking of the statement earlier about the first 3 years. Sometimes it's easy to get a little discouraged and think that.
No. What have I done?
Correct. Correct. This is true. Now listen to this. Children should early. Now that's maybe a bit of ambiguity to it, but it's. I think that we are inclined to make it, you know, mean a little longer or later than we should. Children should early be trained to submit their will and inclination to the will and the authority of their parents. Now, this is a submitting. Now, submission is a willful act done by the person, and it is not something that is forced, but it is something that they are trained to do. Authoritatively, forcefully, to surrender is not submitting. To just simply give in to the, you know, because the stronger force, but to actually train the child to submit that will is an entirely different thing. When parents teach their children this lesson, they are educating them to submit to God's will and authority. And this is the thing we've been trying to work on for a long time. This is the reason for this. If a child is willing to actually submit to the will of his parents, then when it comes to submitting his will and surrendering his life to the Lord, this is a natural process. Yes.
Could I just read something on this very subject? In this book, The Christian Family, he says, willing obedience is based upon the inner foundation of reverence. It is not only a virtue, it is the only virtue of the child. It includes all good that can be required and expected of him. It seems at first sight to be simple obedience to the will of man, yet it is already obedience to God. For in submission to the parents' will, children learn to submit to a will higher than their own.
Right.
Submission to parents is a school for the independent and direct obedience to God, which they will have to render when they no longer live under a parent's authority. It is for this that we educate our children, that in their own time they may follow the will of God and the guidance of His Spirit, not from external force, but from conscientiousness and an impulse from within. To learn obedience is to learn a basic law of spiritual life, for God's authority often comes into our life through human authority. When we know our position under authority, we can relax. Relaxation and trust help us to be receptive to the Holy Spirit. Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, wrote, "It is hard to believe, not because it is hard to understand, but because it is hard to obey. We may teach and reason with our children however much we please and still hold them back from a genuine encounter with God, unless with our teaching we have also instilled in them a sense of obedience. God doesn't reveal himself to armchair theorists, but to those who obey."
Amen. Now, this is the section here that really gets down to the nitty-gritty of this matter of the will. To direct the child's development without hindering it by undue control should be the study of both parents and teacher. Too much management is as bad as too little. The effort to break the will of a child is a terrible mistake. The effort to break the will of a child is a terrible mistake. You may break a horse, but not a child. Minds are constituted differently. While force may secure outward submission, the result with many children is a more determined rebellion of the heart. And you've seen this occur. Even Should the parents or teacher succeed in gaining the control he seeks, the outcome may be no less harmful to the child. Yes, Don.
You've been making a lot of statements about the will, with the word will in it. The question in my mind is, do we really understand what this word will means?
Well, as far as I am concerned, I am willing to take the definition that Mrs. White gives us here that I read first. The will is the power of decision. It's the power to choose. It is this that God gave back. You see, it is this that Adam surrendered when sin came in. He had no power to choose. He was totally void of the ability to choose. When he sinned, he became a slave. He lost his legal right to choose. He lost his physical or mental capacity to choose. It was gone. Christ came to give him back that power to choose. And this is what frustrated Satan.
That's the power of the will, not willpower. Is that right?
This is not, we're not talking about willpower. We're talking the power of the will. And when actually Christ came back and gave man the power to choose between Christ and Satan, this is what the power of the will is. This frustrated Satan terribly because he had no idea in the world that he was going to be hindered in his control of the human family. We're told that Satan felt and he planned that if he got Adam and Eve to sin, he would have the whole human family and there would be helpless victims in his hands. But when Christ came back and gave them the power to choose again, this just put him entirely in a different ballpark. He just didn't know what to do. And he had began planning the strategy that he would actually go.
Is it safe to say that any decision that we make or that our children have to make is a, would you say, a life and death matter? Because if we understand that all impulses come to us either from Christ or from Satan, from good or evil, then no matter how innocent something may seem, it has its basis in one or the other. And so decision,
I think that this is an oversimplification of the situation. I don't think it matters whether I choose to put on brown shoes or black shoes, but it's the power of choice nevertheless. I don't think it has anything to do with salvation.
And this is where parents overmanage their children when she's talking about this controlling every breath. Don's been trying to.
Yes.
Is it more the tendency of all the choices that you make that determines the route that you make?
The habitual
yeah.
life.
Yes. The thing is that it is in this area of value decisions where actually the parent must make the decision for the child, but the child must be trained to make decisions that are not what we call value decisions, because they're not capable of that. But surely, when the child gets up in the morning, it's a wonderful training exercise to say, Susie, would you rather wear your blue dress or your green one today? And let her make decisions that are not important, but yet she's making decisions. Rather than laying it out, you wear this, like it or not, you know.
Somebody
had to hand it. Yeah. Don, go ahead.
I think that when she talks about breaking a child's will, I think that perhaps we do this many times in not letting our children learn to make decisions for themselves.
Correct.
And I think that this can be done very early.
Oh, very definitely. Very early.
Somebody had their hand up.
Yeah, somebody else had their hand up. Who was it back there? Well, all right. Now, since the surrender of the will is so much more difficult for some pupils than for others, the teachers should make obedience, and this could be the parents also, to his requirements as easy as possible.
It's the mercy part.
You see, this then brings you over here into this area of love, which is the mercy. Balancing the training of the will, and this is a very, very firmness. It's a strong hand, but it is also mingled with mercy and love.
Could I make a little speech here?
Yes,
a short one.
Yes.
I think that
I'll time you.
That's how come there's mothers and daddies.
That's right.
One reason, because usually in a family, daddy is the firm, you know, and the mama is showing a little more mercy, maybe. And I feel like I didn't say I did, but I think I did. But anyway, children, it balances
don't
out.
Don't raise your hands if you.
If a father is a typical, you know, strong, sturdy, firm, the firmer qualities, and the mother is, then the children get the balance.
She calls them the sterner qualities.
The sterner qualities. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. A child may be so trained as to have no will of his own. Children who are thus educated will ever be deficient, note this, will ever be deficient in energy, moral energy, and individual responsibility. Two characteristics that are absolutely just abomination to a person as they go through life. No moral energy and no individual responsibilities.
Just like a lady we were talking about today.
Yes, they have to be taught to move from reason and principle. This is the training of the will. They have to be taught. Now, there's an interesting section here, and I must read this because, All right, there's another one here. When there's a clash of the wills. You've never had this, I'm sure.
Like every day.
Okay. If the child has a stubborn will, and somebody put in a question. What do you do with a child that has a stubborn will?
Yeah, that's one of our questions today.
Okay, and we'll answer this. All right. If a child has a stubborn will, the mother, if she understands her responsibility, will realize that this stubborn will, I hate to read this, is part of the inheritance she has given him.
Of course, she could say he has given him.
Oh, but she put she in there.
It could be either way, though.
It's so much more fun to read it, though, as it is.
I've got some dillies I can read, too.
Okay. She will not look upon his will as something must be broken. There are times when the determination of the mother meets the determination of the child. Do you have any idea what this is talking about? When the firm, matured will of the mother meets the unreasoning will of the child. And when either the mother rules because of her advantage of age and experience, or there is a ruling of the older will by the younger, undisciplined will of the child. At such times, there's need of great wisdom. For by unwise management, by stern compulsion, the child may be spoiled for his life.
This life.
Yes, for this life. Now, this is why I felt we must spend time on this. This child may be spoiled for this life and for the next. By a lack of wisdom, everything may be lost. Everything may be lost here.
Read the rest of it, man.
This is a crisis that should seldom be permitted to come. For both mother and child will have a hard struggle. Great care should be shown to avoid such an issue. But once such an issue is entered into, the child must be led to yield to the superior wisdom of the parent. Let's hope we have it. The mother is to keep her words under perfect control. That's the first step. There are to be no loud-voiced commands. No loud voiced commands.
I think there's some mothers right in this room I know quite well that do just like this.
I'm sure there are.
They don't do what they hadn't ought to do.
Nothing is to be done that will develop a defiant spirit in the child. The mother must study how to deal with him in such a way that he will be drawn to Jesus. She must pray in faith that Satan will not be victor over the child's will. The heavenly angels are watching the scene. Why would heavenly angels be watching such a scene?
It's a matter of life and death.
Because this is a matter of eternity. Parents, if we could only, and I'm not trying to paint a dark picture in any sense of the word, but I'm trying to paint a picture that demonstrates the value of training and saving this will. The mother must realize that God is her helper, that love is her success and her power. That's the mercy side of this. She is a wise Christian. If she is a wise Christian, she will not attempt to force the child into submission. Now that's a rather an interesting statement. Here, when you get into a clash of wills, if she's a wise Christian, she will not attempt to force the child into submission.
But
he still
says just before here, he must be led to yield to the superior wisdom, and it can be done without, just like it says here.
Correct. She will pray, and as she prays, she will be conscious of a renewal of spiritual life within her. And she will see that at the same time the power that is working in her is working also in the child. Now, please, just stop here just a moment. And if one understands the importance of this, it's then facing the fact that this is one of the absolute most important things that you can possibly deal with a child. It is not just simply, who's going to be, come out at the top on this particular incident. That's not the point at all. The point is, child, in the place of being compelled, is led and grows gentler. The battle is gained. Each kindly thought, each patient action, each word of wise restraint is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. The mother has gained a victory, more precious than language can express. She has renewed light and increased experience. The true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world, has subdued her will. There is a peace after the storm, like the sunshine of the sun after the rain.
The thought on this, I was just thinking, as you read the directions here, that mothers who are overburdened, mothers who are trying to carry too much responsibility, too much away from their home, don't have enough time to be, have calm, quiet peace at home. They just can't do this unless a mother devotes her life to, insofar as possible, to the rearing of her children and caring for her home. It's mighty hard. You come rushing in from work and here's the children acting like wildcats, and it's pretty hard for a mother to carry this out unless she can devote her life. If it's the case, it's impossible to do otherwise, the Lord can take care of that. But it's impossible to practice this if you are overtired.
This is so true. All right, now there are, and we only have just a few minutes before I have to relinquish my time. The thing that I would like to do is to stop right here. We're just not going to get through this.
It's so important. Let's take 2 minutes for it.
But the thing that I'd like to do right now is to analyze this particular last paragraph, when there's a clash of the wills. Now, actually, as we read this through, what really factors does this cover? What are the major factors that came to your mind as we read through here? What must we keep in mind? Chuck?
One of the most important that came to my mind is that myself, I lack the wisdom that's needed, and I've got to go to the Lord to get the wisdom to handle the situation.
All right.
The
that's
fact
good.
That came to my mind is that the mother is to come out on the top. And that doesn't mean it in a crude way, but...
No. All right. Jan?
She has to be surrendered.
She has to be surrendered. This is true.
And think about that. I mean, that has to be...
This has to be a part of the program. Anything
the
else?
Child.
Susan?
The child has to be led to surrender, not forced to.
Correct.
Definitely.
All right. Susan?
Janet's got...
All right.
I've got a problem there because I'm trying to visualize a situation and I just can't come up with one that I'd love to hear. For instance,
a friend like here's a child saying something to Mama.
Yeah.
No, I will.
Well, now the thing that
have a mother handle it.
Yeah.
The child hasn't said anything, but you tell them the look in their eye that they are submitting to you. You know, they aren't saying anything, but they're not submitting.
There's usually a few things said.
All right. Now the thing that it seems to me. That is so vitally important here is that in a situation of this kind, that time, and I had to get this twisted out of my mouth, right? But that time is very, very important. That actually time is on your side.
Are you thinking of
this
timing?
Does time. I'm talking about time itself. So many times whenever we come face to face with a rebellious will, we think that, brother, this job's got to be done right now.
Well,
it's got to be done right now. Now,
explain yourself.
All right. Now, if this actually when is followed here, she says the mother must, first of all, never speak in a loud voice. Must never force, must never let the child develop a defiant spirit. She must pray. She must think seriously. She must have every word well chosen and all of this. Does this speak anything to you of the time involved?
Like Johnny's just standing and jumping up and down screaming and mother is doing these things.
But you see, when Johnny's jumping up and just defying you, it's so easy to just grab him and whale the living daylights out of him and have the thing over and you have conquered.
Right, you have a pitiful situation.
Yes.
This thing, do you pray for your children in the room or do you go so much yourself or what?
Listen, I've prayed in far less more favorable or far less favorable circumstances than a crying child.
That's what I mean.
And I'd pray anywhere.
Do you pray?
There is, you don't have to pray out loud even. The thing is that we're told that there is no place where it is inappropriate to pray. So if you ever need to pray,
right then
you need
to
pray.
You don't have to kneel down to pray.
And you need to talk to the Lord earnestly and honestly and sincerely. There's no question.
Should your child hear you?
Pardon?
Should your child hear you?
No.
Well, it wouldn't hurt if he did, but... I mean, in a time like this, if my child's jumping up and down screaming and I want to do the thing this book says, I'm going to be inside saying, help me, Lord, do something to me, make my words right. No?
May only be a sentence or two.
Ellen?
Do you have any thoughts?
Yes.
No, one, it would seem to me that in this particular situation that I should feel off a lot easier and not handle it if I did leave the room for a short period. Another thing about
breaking dishes or something.
I'm going to get to
the
next
slide. I just couldn't think of the instance that was given. All
right.
If the child is doing something to be done, do he stop?
Like throwing dishes on the floor
certainly,
or something.
Certainly. This is fine. But now look it. She says here, and she will see that at the same time the power is working in her. This is when she prays. And actually she will feel the renewing power of God in her life. And she will at the same time see that this power is working, that's working in her is working also in the child. And in the place of being compelled, he is led and grows gentler, and the battle is gained. Each kindly thought, each patient action, each word of wise restraint is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. Now, doesn't this give you an idea that we maybe act too hastily sometimes in this, Bonnie?
I'm just referring to, I don't know, I think sometimes housewives particularly get priorities a little confused in this concept of time. Oh, there's things that we know that we have to do, but really our main job, and
it's
I don't think I really realized it until just now as you're talking, I mean, I know it, but it didn't really hit home. That our main job really is the raising of our children.
Correct.
If you never got the dusting done either.
It doesn't matter, yeah. Right.
That's right.
You know, Janet, I was thinking of it. You asked for a concrete illustration, and I can just think of one here, for instance. When I was visiting my daughter, I hate to use my own family as an illustration, because they're the only ones I know much about, you know, to really firsthand watching. And I was visiting her, and it just seemed like all the kids were acting horrible at once, just terrible. I can't remember just what all was going on, but just general bedlam. And she was very, you know.
That's five bedlams.
And she was feeling quite tried. It was early in the morning. Everybody's got to get off to school and all those things, and then all this commotion. And so she acted unwisely right at first, and she did a little thwacking around saying things she oughtn't to say. And then I noticed she wasn't there. All of a sudden she wasn't there, and the bedroom door was shut. And I knew what she was doing. And pretty soon I noticed one by one the children weren't there either, and they were in the bedroom. And later she told me about it. And the children, she went in there and prayed in the first place and asked the Lord to forgive her for being impatient to begin with. And then she one by one called the children in and apologized to the children that she had been impatient. And they prayed together. And this little story about them, you know, the children becoming gentler and yielding to her will. Before they left, everybody was all calmed down and sweet and doing what Mama wanted them to do. And though she didn't, it wasn't perfect. She should never have had the first up flare, but at least it was handled in a, I felt like, in quite a Christ-like way as we progressed along. Oh.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it? Has this effect on us? If your, I mean, if your husband comes home and barks, what happens?
He wants to see.
You're two barks back.
He wants to say something.
Blue? What's that?
Just trying to get our children to do what we want them to do without the person. That's the best that you ask your child to vacuum the floor. If you don't want to.
Do you ask them? Do you ask your child to vacuum the floor?
I tell her to. I guess.
Sure.
But if she don't want to, do you force her to? Mm-hmm. Or do you work her will?
I don't force her, but she vacuums the floor. This is what we're talking about, the parent coming out on the top. This doesn't have to be a life and death eternal issue.
We're supposed to help her to want to do it.
Yeah,
first.
Certainly.
Yeah. But it isn't it. Well, that's what we were trying to read here in
sometimes
this book. Amen. Yeah. I've got a whole folder here on
my
that.
My attitude, though, toward it can make a big difference, too.
Absolutely.
Chores and things.
Yes, if it's a joy. If the mother sings when she works and it's a happy thing, children will think it's a happy thing.
Yeah. Well, my time is gone, and I'm so sorry.
I'm just sick about it.
She ever gets.
If I ever get straightened out,
gets terribly sick, doesn't she, when she looks at me? All right, Susie.
I was just trying to say that if there's rules about that they have to do either a certain time length of work or a certain job, then you don't have the argument about it. You know, well,
correct.
When you're done, you can play.
Well, we covered the rule of thumb right there on the back of the
room.
We
didn't.
You mean like if you don't get such and such done, you don't get started on whatever
it
wants.
What happens at our house?
Yeah, I remember something.
Well, maybe we can talk on a private basis here.
Yeah, well, I've been having a trouble for 2 years.
What'd you say? What'd you say?
You don't call her, I could have today.
We do appreciate your helping on the expenses, the babysitters, though, on this. And it is quite an essential part of the program. Mother, why don't you come back up here and start in your part of the program?
Oh,
well, they'll bring them up.
So.
I thought you were afraid somebody would walk out the back door.
No, I really don't. I trust them all.